we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Welcome to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. Well, the crisis that has engulfed the British political establishment as a result of Brexit evinces no sign of abating anytime soon. The recent ruling of the UK Supreme Court rejecting the British government's appeal of a previous High Court ruling over where constitutional authority lies when it comes to triggering Article 50, the formal process of the country's exit from the EU. This ruling was tantamount to the judicial caning of a Prime Minister, Theresa May, who 6 months after the referendum vote was taken on June is still to inform the country of what Brexit will look like. Given that Brexit will usher in the most profound political, economic and social change to British society since the Second World War, this lack of a plan and paucity of political leadership is surely of such magnitude that historians will be pondering it in future generations. But a second and even more important aspect to the recent Supreme Court ruling was its dismissal of the case put forward by the devolved Scottish government, led by the Scottish National Party's Nicola Sturgeon, that as a partner nation within the UK, and given that both Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain in the EU referendum, the UK has to consult the devolved parliaments and assemblies with regard to the government's plans for Brexit going forward. Married to Theresa May's dismissal of the concerns of the Scottish government over the democratic deficit thrown up by the EU referendum vote, this legal ruling has many in Scotland and beyond currently speculating that Scottish independence is now a question of when and not if. I am John White, and you're listening to another episode of Hard Facts. Okay, I'm delighted to be joined on today's episode by the Scottish National Party member of the British Parliament, Paul Monaghan. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hello, John. How are you this afternoon?
Very well, very well. Delighted you could join us for this very important episode. Well, let me begin with a point of accuracy, and here it is. The UK did not vote to exit the EU on June 23rd. England and Wales voted to exit the EU, while Scotland and Northern Ireland voted to remain. And for those who make the point that it was a UK-wide vote, here's my answer to that. The UK has no independent existence outside that of its member states and nations, while those member states and nations do have an independent existence outside of the UK. And even if you're accepting that argument that it was a UK-wide vote, and the supplementary arguments bolstering this argument that 2 years ago people in Scotland voted to remain in the UK, they did so, as I did when I cast my vote in that referendum in 2014, on the basis that the UK would remain within the EU. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think you highlight a number of really quite interesting questions. I think the first thing we should make clear is that you're right, the United Kingdom is not a country, it is in fact a political union. And that political union is a union formed of England, clearly, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. And you're right, each of these countries does have its own systems of governance, its own often systems of law, and absolutely its own culture and society. That often isn't recognised. So I think increasingly that will be. The other aspect, of course, is that, you know, you're right, the UK did not vote to leave the European Union. Parts of the UK voted to leave the Union, so the European Union, and other parts voted to very strongly, in fact, to remain within it. You've highlighted Scotland and Northern Ireland, but we could also add into that London. We could also add into that Gibraltar. So there are real differences of opinion around the various parts of the UK as to what that mandate actually means. Now, I would argue that the vote that took place on the 23rd of June last year was a vote about the UK's membership of the European Union. And the UK government, in fact, have interpreted that as being a vote to leave the European Union and a vote to leave the single market, a vote to leave the customs union that allows us to trade with other European nations, and a vote that should bring an end to the free movement of labour, the free movement of goods, services and people. Now, I don't think that many people in the UK voted for all of that. I think some people voted for change. Many people voted to maintain the opportunities and the access to the single market. And I think the UK government's interpretation of the vote, I think, is going to cause significant hardship for individuals. It's going to cause significant hardship for business. And it's going to cause significant hardship for Scotland. I think we need to be absolutely clear that the UK government's interpretation of the vote on the 23rd of June is going to result in all of us being poorer. It's going to result in our businesses struggling, and it's going to result in many of the social connections that we have within our families, but equally across the European Union, probably becoming difficult, if not being brought to an end altogether. So I think the UK government was right to be challenged in the Supreme Court. I think the decision is largely unsurprising. I think the UK government and Theresa May were always going to be challenged. They were always going to be told Parliament, the UK Parliament that is going to have a vote on this. That vote clearly now will happen. We, as a party, are pressing the UK government to produce a white paper. We want to know the detail of what this vote will be about. We are very likely to put forward amendments to the government's bill. And, you know, all of that, I suspect, will happen next week. But beyond that, again, another point that you've highlighted, the UK Supreme Court said that the devolved nations, the devolved parliaments of the devolved nations, should have no say in this process. Quite frankly, John, that's a massive slap in the face to the people of Scotland, the people of Wales and the people of Northern Ireland. We absolutely have a right to have our voice heard in this whole process. The Scottish Government has already said that the Scottish Parliament will have a vote on the issue, and they're right to do that. Above all, we must represent the interests of the 62% of people in Scotland that voted to stay within the European Union. That's our obligation, that's our responsibility, and that's exactly what we intend to do. It's in the interest of the Scottish people, and if we did anything less, quite rightly, we would be criticised for it.
Indeed, and just to emphasise the point regarding the Supreme Court ruling, this has the effect of reducing Scotland's status to that of a region of the UK rather than a partner nation, so it has really serious ramifications as to the status of the UK. You're right, it's not a country, it's not a nation, it's a state. It's a political entity involving three different countries or statelets regarding Northern Ireland, depending on your view, who are voluntarily involved in a union. So I think the Supreme Court has actually set a hare running that we can only raise grievances in Scotland or exacerbate grievances that were already in existence with regard to Scotland's status in the UK. And obviously this is exacerbated further by the fact that currently there is only one Conservative Party Member of Parliament in Scotland. So Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the SNP, was right to point that up. And I want to talk about the difference in political culture, because this is something that I had resisted up till now. I resisted the idea that there was a marked difference in political culture between Scotland and parts of England, or significant parts of England. That's no longer tenable, that argument. And it really was brought home to me the morning after the vote was taken on June 23rd, on the morning of June 24th, Nicola Sturgeon's press conference, her first press conference responding to the result, I thought was a tour de force, because she is the only leader who emerged with any credibility from this morass, this reactionary swamp, is how I would describe Brexit. When she extended the hand of solidarity and reassurance to EU migrants living in Scotland, and by extension minorities and migrants of all nationalities, non-EU as well as EU. And there is a difference in political culture, because what's happening in parts of England is this ugly, nativist, xenophobic hysteria on the issue of migrants, is particularly with free movement. And we no longer do we hear about the role of the banks in crashing the economy. We no longer hear about Tory austerity and ravaging the lives of working class communities and people all across the country. Everything now is migrants, it's immigration. This is a very worrying trend, and this is why I have no problem saying that Brexit was merely the UK manifestation of the rise of the far right across Europe. And we do see a difference between an inclusive Scottish nationalism and an exclusive and ugly nativist British counterpart. What are your thoughts on that, Paul?
I think there's some truth in what you say. I think you're absolutely right. On the 24th of June last year, I think the one thing that was obvious to everybody was that the UK government had embarked upon this referendum without seriously having given any thought whatsoever to the prospect of a vote in favour of leaving the EU. And they were exposed because they had no plans, no strategies, no answer to any of the substantive questions that people started to ask. What will the UK look like in the future outside of Europe? They were bereft of answers on that, and I thought that that was absolutely lamentable on the part of the UK government.
Yeah.
The other, you know, you're absolutely right to highlight the emphasis that the Leave campaign placed on immigration, illegal immigrants, refugees, all of that, free movement of people.
All thrown into the same box, weren't they? Refugees, illegal immigration and free, all thrown into the same box, even though they're entirely distinct categories.
Absolutely. That was the shameful aspect of it, I think. You know, clearly illegal immigration is something that we don't want, but, you know, free movement of people, accepting our responsibility towards refugees, you know, these are things that we should be standing up for and taking responsibility for. And to, as you say, put them all into the same category and highlight the fact that none of these people were welcome in the UK, that they were in some way work shy or spongers or leeching off the state, I just thought was absolutely disgraceful. But it did unfortunately develop traction as an idea in significant areas of England. It was an attractive policy. I think it encouraged a lot of people to vote.
Yeah.
For a Leave vote, that did, I think, represent a shift to the political right to some extent. I'm very proud of the fact that Scotland didn't take on board those arguments, wasn't persuaded by them, and took a different line. I think in Scotland, we have always been internationalist in outlook.
Yeah.
We've always been outward-facing. We've always been a compassionate society that seeks to hold out a helping hand to people that are vulnerable or needing support or assistance in some way. And that's exactly what we did on the 23rd of June. I'm very proud of that, as I've said, and that's something that we should absolutely stand by. It's important that everybody knows that the free movement of labour, the free movement of people across the EU is something that we benefit from immeasurably in Scotland. You know, EU nationals coming to work here are vital to our agricultural sector. They're vital to our tourism sector. They're vital to almost every single industry and business in Scotland. And Nicola Sturgeon was absolutely right to make sure that those people knew that they were welcomed in Scotland and are continue to be welcome in Scotland. And at a local level, I can tell you, John, that I wrote to every single EU national in my constituency personally, making it absolutely clear that they have my support. They are welcome here. They're valuable. Contribution to our society and to our businesses and our economy is something that we are grateful for, and that if in any way they felt I could help them, then they should never hesitate, get in touch immediately. That was well received.
Yes.
It was well received across Scotland. So I think, you know, again, back to your initial point, the fact was that the UK government embarked on something here that they did not properly consider. They did not look at the potential ramifications, and quite frankly, they were caught on the hop. They've been shown to be deficient in their thinking. And here we are, the best part of 6 months later, and still the UK government has no plans to deal with this vote. On contrast, Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish government have produced a comprehensive document, a comprehensive set of proposals as to how Scotland in particular can move forward. The challenge really is for Theresa May and her UK government to look at that document seriously and start to have sensible discussions with the Scottish government. I suspect that's not going to happen, however, and that might lead on to other political events in the future. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, well, I'd like to stop there for a quick break. Please don't go anywhere. Join us after the break. Hard Facts. OK, welcome back to the second half of this special episode of Hard Facts on the recent UK Supreme Court ruling regarding Brexit and its ramifications when it comes to the prospects for Scottish independence. Before we get back to our discussion, I'm joined by Paul Monaghan, the Scottish National Party member of the British Parliament. We hit the streets earlier and we got the views of the public and we asked, do you agree with Britain's current immigration policy? Let's have a listen.
absolutely disagree with it. I mean, before the European campaign, during the referendum, before this, people never complained about migrants stealing jobs. They never complained about this. They only started to complain about this when UKIP started to rise and David Cameron, for his re-election, started to blame immigration.
Jobs are created and also immigrants are willing to do jobs that English people, I'm sure that they are not willing to do. Also, not only that, they also do very good jobs, like there are some very clever immigrants, very qualified immigrants that can increase productivity in England, and they can bring a lot of advantages in.
Oh, I would say it's beneficial to have that movement, because you also have that movement of skills as well. But at the same time, I think that if we're bringing people in because we have that lack of skills, and maybe we need to be looking more internally as, at the same time, in terms of developing the skill set of individuals within this country as well. Just kind of getting that balance.
I don't know, capitalism and imperialism has created a system where people need to move around. I mean, not because they want to, but because they have to. So you can't just shut the door, because that's not addressing the actual problem.
That's wrong. I think we should let a lot more immigrants into the country, to be honest. Because if you look at the relativistic populations of, say, the UK and Germany, they've let in far more than we have. And, you know, evidence would say that they don't take other people's jobs and they actually provide a lot for the communities.
I mean, you look at it across Europe as a whole, there's this big seismic change in politics shifting to the right, progressively becoming a lot less liberal, a lot more conservative, and well, for myself, I identify as quite left-wing. These days, I don't see much of what I like in politics represented in the UK, and it's quite worrying, you know?
Well, as you heard, quite informed views, I think, on the issue of immigration in particular. Paul, here's my view on the issue of free movement. The free movement of people stroke labour is but a symptom of the free movement of capital. And as we know, neoliberalism does not sow obscene levels of inequality within states. It also does the same between states. And so the idea that you're attacking these people who are coming over and accusing them of placing downward pressure on wages, which, by the way, is minimal, according to a recent report, is really not only to point your guns at the wrong target, but is to lose sight of reality. Because the fact is that migrants come here, they add to our economy. We are culturally enriched by migrants, and those who try and make this fatuous claim on the left that, you know, the current immigration policy vis-a-vis the free movement of EU migrants is racist because it discriminates against non-EU migrants. Well, non-EU immigration into the UK is still higher than EU migration. The fact is there are 3 million EU citizens currently living in the UK. They work, they pay tax. In many cases, they're married to British citizens, bringing up families. They were denied a vote in the EU referendum, and given that it was really about their future, that was a shocking turn of events. Then there's the 2 million British citizens who live and work across the EU, and their status will now be up for grabs. And what we're seeing is a horrible example of political horse trading when it comes to the fate of millions of human beings whose only crime is to try and provide for themselves and their families. Give me your thoughts on how toxic this anti-migrant hysteria has become, because we've seen a rise in hate crimes. And if I can just interject a personal experience I had on the morning after the Brexit result on June 24th, I was booked to give an interview at a TV studio, and a cab came to pick me up, and the driver was a Polish gentleman, and I'll never forget him turning around and saying, "What do you think this result means for people like me?" He had real fear in his eyes, and at that moment, I have to tell you, I was ashamed. I was ashamed to be a citizen of the UK. Your thoughts, please.
I think many people share similar experiences, similar views. I think we all recognise the fact that our friends and colleagues that perhaps originate in some other part of the EU are deeply concerned, deeply worried, and to some extent, in some ways, feel betrayed by the vote on the 23rd of June. It's not what they expected. Quite frankly, it's not what they deserve. I think if we look at the EU and consider what the EU actually is, it's important that we recognise and we remember, in fact, that the EU largely originated in a movement that sought to bring peace to Europe and to sustain peace in Europe. And it's done that very successfully. We should never, ever forget that. I mean, it's not even 100 years ago since, you know, European nations were fighting one another, killing one another and, you know, destroying everything that we hold dear today. So, you know, that's something that was very special about the EU, and we should never underestimate the importance of that. I think, you know, looking to the future, some of the rhetoric that we now hear coming out of the UK government smacks of isolationism and protectionism, and you know that is never ever healthy. You know, the free movement of capital, the free movement of people, the free movement of goods and services are, you know, not just economically important, but they're vital to our standing as a culture, as a society, and to a civilization, in fact. You know, there's hardly one among us now who does not have family connections with individuals from the EU. It might be because one of our families have married into somebody from another European country, or we work beside them, or, you know, a whole host of things. But they absolutely do bring something to our day-to-day life that's positive and that we welcome and that we absolutely value. You know, I can think of countless examples of where EU nationals are contributing to our economy in a way that we never, ever would. I mean, historically, language skills, for example, in Scotland amongst the Scottish people have never been great. But the EU nationals come here, they work in our tourist sector, for example, and they bring the language skills that we vitally need. That's just one example. I look at academia and I think, you know, what is the purpose of academia? Academia should be about being inventive. It should be about developing the ingenuity of mankind. It should be about getting the brightest and best people to work together on social projects, on scientific projects that in some way move us all forward. You know, I've got research institutes in my constituency that absolutely relies on other EU countries and the free movement of skills and knowledge to be able to develop those objectives. These are all things that we benefit from. They're not a threat to our society. And anybody that tries to present these important aspects of our day-to-day life as in some way being threatening or some way being negative, I think is getting things badly, badly wrong. You know, we have got nothing to fear from the European Union. Scotland has got nothing to fear from working in partnership with other EU nations. In fact, we've got everything to gain from doing that, and we must never lose sight of that objective.
Well, here we may slightly disagree, Paul. Being someone of a left-wing persuasion, I do see that the EU does have some very serious structural problems and ideological problems. But that's only a reflection of the dominant ideology, which is the neoliberalism that I mentioned earlier. There is issues of democracy and transparency, and a lot of people look at the Greek crisis of 2015 and the way that the Troika, the European Central Bank, the European Commission and IMF imposed hyper-austerity on the Greek people, really in the interests of the German economy, the German government. So that's a real problem, and I think that fed an anti-EU sentiment, certainly on the left, in large sections of the left. But notwithstanding that, the EU can be reformed. It must be reformed. But economically, most of our investment comes from the EU. 3.6 million British jobs are dependent on Britain's membership of the single market currently, and that's from Civitas, which is a Eurosceptic think tank. These were figures compiled in September 2016, and 250,000 of those jobs are Scottish jobs. So regardless of the weaknesses of the EU, and there are weaknesses, there are also weaknesses with its ever-increasing politicisation and even militarisation, but notwithstanding those weaknesses, what we're talking about with regards to this British nationalist sentiment which is driving Brexit is a Britain that's embarked on a journey back to the 19th century. And people in Scotland and Northern Ireland, in Northern Ireland they have real issues with regards to the implications for the Good Friday Agreement. People in Northern Ireland and Scotland want to remain in the 21st century because whether they like to believe it or not, these Brexiteers, we live in an interdependent world. There's no escape hatch from that world with these votes that we can suddenly be unshackled, as they would describe it, from the clutches of Brussels and go off into the sunset and make all these fantastic new trade deals with China and Australia and the United States and so on. Because what these people don't realise, I think, in their illiteracy, is that Chinese investors, for example, when they look to invest in the UK, they do so on the basis that the UK has access to the single market, the largest tariff-free market in the world, 500 million consumers. What do you think's driving this idiocy? Because that's what it has to be described as, Paul, this sort of economic illiteracy. Do you think these people are so blinded to the facts that they've been so overcome and intoxicated with this British nationalism?
I think the first thing to say is that nobody would seriously pretend for a minute that the EU, the European Union, was perfect. It clearly isn't perfect. No system of government is perfect. But we do have a responsibility, I think, to work within it, to improve it, and make it better for the future and more responsive. So, you know, you've highlighted your own personal issues with ideology. I would highlight some issues with the democratic deficit that exists within the EU and across the EU. But these are things that, you know, we should be rolling up our sleeves and getting involved to try to sort out, not to walk away from. I think that's an important point. You're right also, absolutely right, to highlight the fact that the single market in particular is important to jobs across the UK, and that encourages investment and international trade. You know, all of these things I think are obvious. It's worth saying that, you know, our figures suggest that a hard Brexit, which is what we're facing at the moment, will cost 80,000 jobs in Scotland. You know, there's a very difficult question there to answer in terms of how those 80,000 jobs would be replaced and when they would be replaced. That's hardship that we just don't need.
Yes.
You've suggested that, you know, in some respects, the UK is heading back towards the 19th century. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you. I think any country that is starting to think about policies that are isolationist, that are protectionist, is going in the wrong direction. The world absolutely isn't interdependent now. We do rely on trade internationally, and that's quite right. Again, I don't think we've got anything to fear from that. We shouldn't be trying to escape from it. I don't think we could even if we wanted. Trade deals are vitally important. We need to get the best possible trade deals. And in Scotland, arguably, that's even more important because in many respects, we have a geographical distance to overcome from the markets themselves. So the last thing that we need to be doing in Scotland is in some way making ourselves less competitive. We need to be more competitive. We need to make sure that we're producing services and goods that are of a high quality and are attractive to the EU single market and to other markets around the world. But what were people voting for? I think in some respects, on the 23rd of June, a lot of people were voting for change.
Yes.
They were voting for change. They were voting.
People who've been suffering under the ravages of 6 years of Tory austerity. And these are the people, this is my point, Paul, these are the people that will be Brexit's biggest victims. The people, the working class communities in the country's former industrial heartlands in the north and the Midlands and South Wales, they will be its biggest victims because it's not going to usher in a new dawn of Keynesian economics and socialism. It's going to usher in hyper austerity and hyper-Thatcherism. That's what it's going to do. And if we don't resist it, we will see the entrenchment of Tory ideas for possibly for a generation or more.
I think probably for more than a generation, to be honest with you. But yeah. Again, I think I would agree with you. I think what many people were voting for on the 23rd of June was change. It was a reaction and a demand for change as a consequence of the impact on their lives and the quality of their lives in terms of the Conservative government's austerity agenda. And you're right, many of the people that voted for that change, sadly, are going to be the victims of an impoverished society because we're out of the EU, trade will be more difficult, the cost of living is going to go up, incomes are going to go down, yeah. And you know, they were the very people who were voting for the opposite of that.
Paul Monaghan, thank you very much for your insights, and thank you out there for listening to another episode of Hard Facts. However, it does not need to be the end of the conversation. Please give us your comments, please contribute to the Facebook page, Sputnik International, and likewise on Twitter. And just remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.